On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Ich habe nach Hause zurückgekehrt, or something like that. I'm back home. I am back home after, God almighty, a long, long time away from the microphone. Almost, well, I haven't spent more time away from the microphone since my father died. It's a minute past the hour of 6 o'clock. It is Monday. It is the 4th of June. I am Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. The Head On Radio Network, headonradionetwork.com, available for your listening pleasure at a variety of platforms, including headonradionetwork.com, iTunes Radio, TuneIn Internet Radio, TuneIn Radio, our good friends at Stitcher Radio, and on and on and on, with, of course, podcasting originating from whiterosesociety.org. Okay, I got that part right. You know what? I've been kind of a mess all day long trying to figure out how I would go about telling this story. Because it's been a long one in the making. It goes all the way back to the bidding farewell before Ferg and I took off for Wisconsin. And then immediately transitioned to me, for all intents and purposes, family-wise, soloing across the Atlantic, and what was an absolute whirlwind few days that then settled down and then finished off with one more bank and then home via Amsterdam. So there's a lot of ground to cover tonight. As I threatened in a Twitter/Facebook post, this may be an epic filibobster, just for the sake of getting the story out. And you're going to have to bear with me. There are some technical glitches at play here that I'm going to have to remedy, and this is one of them. Stand by, please. One gets used to, after a while, having things a certain way when one begins to broadcast at any given evening. And equipment plays a big part in that. More on that later. I was trying out some new in-ear monitors that it turns out that I hate. So I've gone back to old-fashioned cans, my good old Sennheisers. No, really, where to begin? Ferg and I flew out to Wisconsin in the middle of the month for a couple of speaking engagements, one of which was at Fightin' Bob Fest North in Chippewa Falls. That's how you have to say it, by the way. I know it looks like Chippewa. It's Chippewa. Chippewa Falls. Right? Everywhere I go, I try to learn to speak the language. We had a magnificent time in Wisconsin. Seeing that kind of small-town America was inspiring. And to see it at a time such as it is, such as will be borne out in a plebiscite tomorrow, and to catch the fire and the excitement that surrounded the hopeful recall of an individual who is certainly turning out to be a dubious character at best, namely Scott Walker, to be out there for that and to have been invited there by Ed Garvey, who founded the Fighting Bob Fest with the advocacy by our good friend Bruce, to get me there to talk about mountaintop removal and to talk about what it means to when the 1% is willing to literally destroy your home in order to maximize their profits, their gains. Well, it was a deep and abiding honor. So, Ferg has gone off to visit a friend. I'd kind of like to have him here for this because he could give his impressions as well. Ferg was ready to up and move. He's ready to go to Wisconsin just any time. He loves the area. We started out in River Falls and made our on the lovely Kinnickinnick River, I might add. I just love that word. It's probably some Native American word that means, "Dadgum, this is a beautiful place. Why don't we stop here for a while and just spend our lives?" We started out in River Falls and had a magnificent time there. We're wonderfully hosted and spoke to a group of really committed, good, progressive people. There's a lot of those around. And then went on over to Chippewa Falls and were hosted and swanned about, if you will, by our good friend Bruce, and shown the countryside. Yes, I toured the Leinenkugel beer brewery. Leinenkugel makes some very good beer. It's just a damn shame that the ownership is such a bunch of repulsive repiglickets. It's a real conflict. But on Saturday we spoke at the Fightin' Bob Fest North there at the Northern Wisconsin Fairgrounds. It's just beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. And there were a number of speakers who really, really painted in very, very clear pictures what is at stake when people go to the polls tomorrow. And the last I saw polling roll in right before the show that says that Scott Walker is leading Tom Barrett by a margin of about 50-47%. I don't know what that says about the polling. I know what it says about Wisconsin's future if that holds true, because they will be screwed, because the floodgates will open. I mean, hell itself will yawn open wide if Scott Walker is not removed from office. So, listen, if you're in Wisconsin, this is no time to make any sort of assumptions. Go help. In these last remaining waning hours, if you haven't, and many of you have, I know because I get your emails, but if you haven't, go do something. Try to save your state. I mean, I learned about things up there that I didn't know existed. I guess when you sort of idealize a place, it comes as a shock when you find out what the underbelly is. And in this particular instance, the underbelly is that where I was in that region, why the one percenters have decided they want to do a sort of upper Midwest Wisconsin version of mountaintop removal. Only they're calling it sand mining. And where the Appalachians here are relatively large-sized hills that have been worn down over the epochs. You know, the Appalachians were once like the Himalayas. These are rolling hills, and it's lovely countryside. It's beautiful countryside. It's absolutely inspiring to behold. And it turns out that that portion of Wisconsin has underneath it sand. Now they don't have any. Frack gas under them. They're lucky in that regard. But they have sand that is perfect for fracking. And so, lo and behold, companies have moved in and they've done what extraction companies always do, I mean, i.e. to wit, start screwing people left and right to get whatever it is that they want, in this case, sand. And they are literally using many of the same techniques that are used, especially the blasting part, that are used in mountaintop removal to get at the sand, which they then take by truck to a railhead and then go and put on and put on the train and send it to somewhere that they're fracking. Because it's just apparently the absolute end of all the best sand you can have if you want to go and destroy the water table to somebody that happens to have some Marcellus shale or significantly or similarly deep buried shale gas underneath them. It really. So, in other words, these folks in Wisconsin will have their water ruined, their water poisoned, their air poisoned, so that it can be, so that their sand can be taken somewhere else to poison somebody else's air, land, and water. Somehow you get, and you know, my only message was that, they got to stop it. Wow, we're having issues here. Going in and out on the volume, and it's low, I'm told. Thanks, Isaac. Huh. What have you done? What have you done, Ferg? And, of course, he's not here to show me. Well, we'll have to get through this as best we can. Although I'd really like to know. All right, is that any better? Is that a little bit better, I hope? We'll find out. Yeah, Dr. John, Linies is GOP-owned, and not just GOP-owned, really hateful right-wing, pig-licking, teabagging, I think, GOP-owned. Sure took the summer out of my summer, Shandy, that was for sure. A contribution just rolled in. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much for that. We'll talk about that later. Okay, thanks, Isaac. Isaac says it's better now. See, we even sort of crowdsource some of the on-the-fly engineering here. John and I, when John's got a little time and I've got a little time, we've got some engineering work to do here, but that's neither here nor there. But there is a tremendous amount of energy and a tremendous amount of the future that's on the line in Wisconsin tomorrow. And for those of you who will be going to the polls in Wisconsin, I don't want to make too big a deal out of this, but I hope you do understand that it's more than just Wisconsin. The for-profit media will, of course, use the Wisconsin election as the be-all and end-all of what to expect in November. So, please, go get that little thug punk bastard out of office, will you? I guess it's an open question whether he did or did not father a child in college with a woman from whom he walked away. People of the right-wing persuasion have been saying, it's a smear, not a real... It's been debunked over to the Daily Caller. But I did some reading, and it doesn't look as... That story doesn't look as debunked as some might originally note. The reporter who wrote the so-called debunking, of course, works for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which has, interestingly enough, endorsed Scott Walker. How about that? Meanwhile, it's kind of a non-denial denial anyway, and I tend to trust a scientist with a personal reputation on the line over somebody working as a journalist for an organization that has a dog in the hunt, so to speak. I mean, why didn't the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel post this as a real newspaper story instead of a blog post? Inquiring minds want to know. But even if that's not true, It is worth noting. It is worth noting, as I mean, this is what Wisconsin has in the form or in the person of Scott Walker. And I can only tell you that it is not impressive. Not at all. This is just a little rundown that I got via Bruce of what Scott Walker is all about. Listen carefully, if you will, please.
Crime and corruption. The FBI has an ongoing criminal investigation into actions around Scott Walker when he was a politician in Milwaukee. So far, six close Walker associates have been charged or charged and convicted of 15 felonies and 3 misdemeanors. Now, the investigation of illegal activities has closed upon Scott Walker. Walker has transferred tens of thousands of dollars into a criminal defense fund. He has refused to disclose the transcript of his meetings with prosecutors. Crime and corruption. You stand with a career politician under criminal investigation. Read more about the investigation. Links to court documents and newspaper articles can be found at walkerinvestigation.com. Paid for by the Pierce County Democrats, Karen White and Treasurer.
And good on the Pierce County Democrats for putting that out there. Because the guy is, I don't know, what's a good adjective here? He's Nixonian, isn't he? Yeah. Oh, thanks. Thanks, Ray. He said, whatever adjustment you made a moment ago sounds great on iTunes. I just kind of tweaked up the game. And the funny thing is, this time I was trying to be prepared, all Boy Scoutish. I tested the system earlier, and it seemed okay. But, yeah, levels are kind of weirdly low, and I'd like to know why Ferb did that to me. Yeah, I don't know what he messed with. Oh, well. But let's go on. So upon leaving Wisconsin, here's how it shook out. We flew home, and boy, were our arms tired. Yeah, I'll be here all week. Try the deal. Don't forget to tip your waiter. We flew home from Wisconsin, Ferg and I, and I had one day of sort of rest, and then the following Monday, I got back on a plane in Charleston, West Virginia, flew to Atlanta, and that was an adventure in its own right because the flight was almost canceled, which would have thrown everything into chaos. But we got through and got to Atlanta, and they've got a brand new international terminal that's open down there that I think it has 8 gates to it. And as it seems to turn out that everywhere I fly, is it this way for you too? Everywhere I fly, whatever gate I'm flying out of, whatever city, the gate I'm leaving is the last one at the end of the concourse. Just say. But it was an Air France 777 bound for Paris. At that point in time, a huge thunderstorm, because there was a tropical depression sort of lingering off the North Florida, Georgia coast. Huge thunderstorm rolled up over Atlanta. You know, lots of lightning and thunder and the half-dollar-sized raindrops. And so everything got delayed. And the flight leaving Atlanta for Paris was delayed by about, an hour. And that 777 holds a lot of people, all of whom were clustered down there at the very end of the new international terminal at Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta. One of the groups that was going to be flying on that plane was apparently, and I found out later, they were from Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. They were a choral singing group on their way to, I don't know, but on their way to somewhere in Europe to sing. And they were warming up just trying to keep the pipes loose, and they were singing, and so the sky has turned to something that looks like a bruise. I mean, the outside of the airport looked like something that you would expect to see the Lloyd Bridges in an airport airline uniform standing inside the glass talking about it being a bad day to quit sniffing glue. And I'm not the happiest of flyers anyway. So this huge crowd is in there. Most of the language you can hear being buzzed about is English, but there's a smattering of German, a smattering of French, and a couple of various and sundry other tongues. But rising up above all the hubbub is this little choral group singing churchy kind of music that sounded like it came from the soundtrack to The Omen. Or maybe The Exorcist. And the rain's falling, and the thunder's booming, and the lightning's striking. And I'm thinking, come on, anything, please. Michael, row the boat ashore. I mean, give us, you know, skip a bit, brother. Give us something with a little bit of life to it, a little something optimistic or hopeful or happy. You know, for God's sakes, the ode to joy, anything. And, you know, any time that you complain like that into the ear of the universe, remember, God is a God of irony. So what did I get instead? I'm standing there getting ready to get on my first transatlantic flight in something like, let's see, 34 years. And my nicotine Jones is kicking in pretty good on something, and the flight's going to be 9 hours long anyway. And I had left my nicotine gum in the vehicle, so I was SOL for that. And the choral group from Sanford University fires up Danny Boy. Danny Boy! You know the one I'm... Danny Boy! You know, the line's about "For you must go and I must die" or something like that, right? And I just looked over toward it and I thought, no, really, you're kidding. And I was trying to hang on. I was trying to save what phone battery I had. So, no, I didn't video them. It was too much. But eventually we did get on the plane. The plane was operated by Air France. And it was, even back there in steerage, and I mean, please. Me and another, me and a 300-pound guy were seated right next to each other in the middle of the center row. No aisle seats for us. Have you noticed that? The airlines are actually now selling aisle seats. You know, back in economy, you know, steerage, they're selling the aisle seats. They're holding those out for people who are willing to pay a little bit of extra money to be able to get up and without crawling across two or three other passengers. Ah, the free market. So it was a little tight. And the flight wound up leaving about 7 o'clock or so. And, of course, that meant that it was already 1 a.m. when we left. But anyway, the bottom line is we arrived in Paris at about 8 and we're off the plane by about 8:15, 8:30. And for me, it was magic. Even something as plain as an airport wasn't plain. It was Paris. And I hadn't had a lot of sleep, and I was a little bit, whoop, because you can't sleep in those seats. And you sort of squirm around a lot and try to straighten your legs out as much as you can. But the minute I watched us land. That was another little cool thing. I know, this is so country mouse, but it's part of the whole story. That Boeing 777 had a camera in its nose. And so everybody had a little monitor on the back of the seat in front of them for watching movies and such like. And at the beginning of the flight, just the default was to show you the view from the nose of the aircraft. And I've always wanted to be in the cockpit of one of those monster, humongous jets when it takes off. And lo and behold, that was the view you got. We got to watch, first-person view, like in a great video game, ourselves take off. That was really neat. Kudos to the flight attendants and general staff of Air France. They really did make even being in steerage quite nice. But we got on the ground, and all of a sudden I was just right, and I'm decaffeinated and everything, but I was right perked up. And started looking around for somewhere to exchange some currency and get ripped off, because, you get ripped off in the airport. Eventually waited for my bag, and then with the kind assistance of my contact there in Paris, a brilliant young man by the name of Ronac, found my way from Charles de Gaulle via the train and then via the Paris metro into the very heart of Paris itself. And I came hiking up out of the metro, dragging a monster suitcase and my backpack with me. More on that later. And found myself staring at the Louvre. Yeah, I was dumbfounded. But there wasn't a lot of time for standing and staring like the tourist that I wasn't. I was there to do business. I was there, in point of fact, because a magnificent organization in Germany by the name of Urgewald that has an amazing staff, Urgewald, Urgewald, urgewald.de. They do amazing work around all manner of human rights abuses as perpetrated by banks and industry in Germany. And they had coordinated with another awesome organization, Les Amis de la Terre. How's that, huh? How's that for 31-year-old high school French? Not too bad, no? They had coordinated with them to make sure that we could also, and the purpose of these was visiting the annual shareholder meetings of these banks that finance mountaintop removal. The very idea I find repugnant. But they do. Because a one percenter is a one percenter, whether they speak French, German, Italian, Spanish, English, or American. The 1% are the 1%. And please understand, I got this driven home in bold-faced print, the 152-point typeset clarity. The 1% have no national allegiances whatsoever. The 1% are in it for the 1%. Now, what was interesting is that the shareholders of these various and sundry banks were not necessarily 1%ers. These are pensioners, some of them. There are certainly a lot of 1%ers in there, but some of these were just working folks who had bank stocks in their portfolios, because bank stocks used to be something that you could conservatively have in your portfolio and feel pretty good about. Emphasis on the phrase, used to be. So yeah, I came hiking up out of the Paris metro right there at the Louvre, because the first meeting we were attending was already underway because my flight was late getting into Paris. It was already underway, and it was a meeting of a financial institution in France called Crédit Agricole.
Farmers Bank, as far as I can translate. And we went in there, and it was as compared to my host was astonished when I told him the story of the shareholder meeting of Bank of America there in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, with the off-duty cops armed to the teeth, and the undercover plainclothes rent-a-thugs, one in every aisle with a gun, and you know, ready to shoot anybody that they felt like needed a good killing. He was dumbstruck by it, amazed by it, shocked by it. But not too shocked because, you know, it's America. And I could understand his surprise when we went into the annual general meeting there, my first ever, of Crédit Agricole. Because there it was all polite formality. It seemed like probably 200 absolutely stunningly beautiful young French women had just been beamed off of fashion runways somewhere and put into smartly tailored bank uniforms. And they were the first line of defense that you met, and it was total politeness. It was, I guess, a manifestation of the velvet glove on an underlying iron fist. But we went through there, and we went into this was all taking place at the Arc du Carrousel, and the meeting hall was sort of in a bunker under the Louvre. And we went in and waited our turn and presented via translation, presented our statement calling for Crédit Agricole, who had been verified as participating in the destruction, poisoning, agony, misery, and death that attends mountaintop removal here in Appalachia. And it was really rather neat because the crowd was in no happy mood with their directors in the first place and were already in a disgusted state with them and yelling accusations and questions at the front of the house. And when we told them we wanted mountaintop removal and their financing of it stopped, and mentioned a little bit about the diseases that stalk this region, we were actually applauded. Having accomplished our goal there, we walked outside, but before we could leave the meeting, lo and behold, a vice president or something came out to tell my colleague that we would that they didn't think they were participating in it, but they would certainly look into it. My colleague then turned to me and said, in wonderful English, "He's full of bullshit." Then explained that he knew damn good and well what they were doing, but that this was the kind of the check is in the mail sort of response that one gets. That left us a little bit of time. And it left time for lunch, and so I got to sit and have lunch on outside at a cafe on a street corner in Paris. It was nice. For those of you keeping up with the food porn portion of the program, I had veau provençal, a lovely stew of veal with vegetables in a wonderful, wonderful broth, served with amazing bread, and a glass of cold white wine, followed by a decaf espresso at the end that was delightful. And Renac and I engaged in conversation, talking about the 1%. We talked some about Occupy. I talked more about exactly what is going on here in Appalachia. And I think it is a fair statement to say that he was both shocked and horrified. And after that, we dragged my monster suitcase and my backpack, more on that later, to our second meeting, which would prove to be considerably different than the first. The second meeting was Société Générale, and at that point in time, I was operating on something like 36 hours without sleep, but still holding my own. In Société Générale, I had one of those little translation headsets and could hear what was being said. You know, it's the same story everywhere you go where the 1% are concerned. But these being European banks, they were trying to be very, very low-key about the whole euro problem and the whole possibly falling apart economy problem, and the and words like Greece were mentioned in very hushed tones so as not to rile the shareholders, who were riled anyway. We finally got to the question and answer part of the program. Yes, I am a Philistine, Ron and Raleigh. Say what? Veal with white wine? Philistine? Yeah, but it was warm outside, and I just sensed that there would be a headache coming from all the tannins in the red wine. And besides, veal is more white than red. So I didn't feel completely, totally Philistinic. And it was tasty anyway. Inside the meeting of Société Générale, we finally got our chance to speak, and basically it was the same speech we had used at Crédit Agricole. But boy, did we get a different reception. We got screamed at by the French. They were hateful. And the way it worked, there were microphone positions throughout the hall. And you stood up to one of yours and waited, the nearest one to you, and waited your turn. And as we stood there, Ronak was standing there translating, and I was standing there, and had some pictures to show him of what Mountaintop looked like. And this cranky little Frenchman gets up and starts berating me. No, I'm not kidding. It comes up and starts poking me in my arm, and of course almost stereotypical the Hollywood movie French accent said, "You coward American, you come and peek on our French banks, you coward, why don't you go home and peek on your American banks?" It's a delightful moment. Like I said, my high school French was something like 32, 33 years old and had not been much in use and wasn't much use to begin with. But one of the beauties of, at least it used to be, one of the beauties of language learning in high school is that, you know, every high school kid taking a foreign language wants to learn how to swear in said foreign language. And it was, let me take a moment to reiterate the value of great teachers and my appreciation of them. Because I was blessed to have wonderful teachers as a kid. And I knew it then, and I was reminded again. Because that little Frenchman, while my colleague was speaking to the board, it was... at me. And my colleague was kind of looking out the corner of his eye. I turned to my right, and the little dude was a good foot and a half shorter than me, and he was an old guy. Maybe in his 70s, maybe in his 80s. There for the free food. More on that later. And I turned to him, and for the first time in my life, well, not really the first time, but, well, yeah, for the first time, because any other time we did it, it was sort of deliberate. But for the first time in my life, I understood what one of these fundamentalist right-wing, or one of these fundamentalist Christians feels when they get slain in the spirit, and they just start babbling. No, I didn't start babbling, and I didn't thump the little 5 feet nothing guy on the top of his little head. I just turned to him and hissed in a very low voice. Fermez ma bouche, cochon. Je parle ici maintenant. And it was straight out of French 2 in 11th grade. Shut up, you pig. I'm speaking here now. And this just beautiful sense of, I don't know, national honor? Or, I mean, because, see, I went over there and I didn't want to take any of the typical American, ugly American prejudices with me. Because I didn't want to be that guy. I had a mission, I had a purpose, and I wanted to fulfill that, and that alone. I wanted to stand up and speak to these people, tell them what they were doing, and tell them what it meant back here at home. And so here's this little guy and his cranky wife carping and calling me a coward for peeking on these French bank. But God bless you, Madame Williams. Some of that teaching stuck. And in that one tiny little moment, I had what I needed. And it was magnificent. Because, you know, being a disgusting American, of course, I wasn't supposed to even understand a word of French. That's why he was speaking to me in English. And when those two short sentences came hissing out from between my teeth, he looked like he had been stricken by a thunderbolt from Zeus himself. And he turned and tottered back over to his seat and sat down. By this time, the rest of the audience was screaming at my colleague, "Question! Question! Question!" Get to the question. Get to the point. But he was not fazed. And he made them sit there and listen to it and pay close attention to what it was they were paying to have done. What was included in what little profit they got. Because as shareholders, they were getting something like a quarter of a penny a share, if that. And we got done, and we packed up, and we walked out. But not before we got an answer, I in translation, my colleague in French, of course. And the response of Société Générale was that, no, they most assuredly did not finance mountaintop removal, and could not, and would not financially support companies that ever did such a thing. They were, in a word, lying. Because we had the data. BankTrack follows the money and does it very, very well. And so that bank, as well as Credit Agricole's association with companies like Alpha Natural Resources and formerly Massey and Consol Energy and Arch Coal and Patriot, Peabody and the usual suspects, was as plain as day. So that was pretty much the end of the work day in Paris, and we exited the hall. Both of these Parisian bank shareholder meetings were held in, I don't know what else to call them, bunkers. They were held in vast underground auditoriums that went 2-3 levels below the earth. I thought it a bit strange. They were both set up in the same fashion with the same phalanx of beautiful young women backed by burly guys with things coming out of their ears. But at least there weren't any weapons on display. So we finished up. Caught a cab. Oh.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Thank you. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Because it was asparagus season, and they go absolutely wild for white asparagus. Understandably, as it is delicious. Then I was going to try some of the local brew. Not swilling, trying. But on our way to pick out a restaurant, it was explained to me by Catherine and Birte, my friends, that yes, the Nazis were on the rise in Germany, and that it was particularly galling because they had gotten enough of a percentage of the vote to achieve federal election funding so that the taxpayers of Germany were actually paying to support the nascent, resurgent NPD, otherwise known as Nazis. We were still getting to know one another, and I was proud to find out that they despised them. And they told me that the NPD came through Wachendorf and plastered their stupid little stickers on all the light poles, and then proceeded to ask me if I would like to join them in going and removing said Nazi stickers from the light poles. At which point I said, "Oh yes, do please." And so we did, as we walked around the town, removed Nazi stickers from light poles. But here's the funny thing. And I'm not calling anybody a Nazi except the Nazis, you know, and that's because they are. Here's the interesting thing. The stickers were translated for me, and every last one of them, if you didn't tell them that it was a slogan from the Nazis, would be any one of those principles that were set forth on those stupid little stickers would be right at home. Where? In any state or the National Republican Party platform. Let's see. I think I've got photographs of a few of them here. Let's have a look. Yeah. Here we go. And like I said, these were translated for me so that I could understand them. Oh, here's one now. Gute Geste kommen, Gute Geste gehen. It is, of course, a photograph of a group of women with kerchiefs over their heads. Good guests come, good guests leave. Immigration. They don't like the immigrants. They particularly don't like the Muslim immigrants, these filthy little Nazis. That was one of them. Oh, yes. Global dient dem Kapital, sozial geht nur national. You can't be socialist without being nationalist. Get it? National socialism? Ever heard of that before? Yes, why, yes, we have. And then, this one. And all of these stickers are in blood red with black print and white fields. The image of what is either a bishop chess piece or, no, it's a minaret tower that is falling from the vertical to the horizontal. The sticker reads, Minaret Verbot. Unser Land in unserer Hand. Minarets forbidden. Verboten. Our land in our hand. Get it? Once again, remember the 9/11 mosque controversy? Of course you do! The not a mosque controversy? I went on, when I saw the good guests come, good guests leave sticker, I couldn't resist telling them the story of Alabama and its miserable right-wing anti-immigrant law and about the German Mercedes-Benz executive who had been told his papers were not in order and was hauled off to the Huskow. And a week later, the either Korean or Japanese auto executive who had had the same thing done to him. My new friends were a bit flabbergasted. But really, and I don't say this as some form of hyperbole, and I don't say this as some form of comparison to whatever went on between the 1930s to 1945 in Germany, really, there are Nazis on the march, on the move, growing in Germany, and they could sit down and talk policy with the Republican Party and not have a moment's disagreement. And that is the absolute God's honest truth. Rotten little bastards, all of them. But I felt a little, I guess, I don't know if patriotic's the right word or not, but I felt a little surge of pride as I got to help tear those stickers off those light poles. Because it was doing something. We went on to have a discussion about the NPD and the fact that they're publicly funded, and my friends were rather perturbed at that. They hated the fact that their tax dollars were literally funding effing Nazis, as I could well understand. And I was told that there is an internal debate going on inside Germany as to whether or not they should be publicly funded or whether they should simply legally be banned as a political party. And I said, my God, they're Nazis. How is there a debate? And it was patiently explained to me that there were some people who said, well, it's better to publicly fund them, that way we can control them. At which point I didn't, although I considered it, I didn't kick furniture. I didn't stomp my foot down. I didn't behave like any form of ugly American. I just looked across the table and I said, now, you know your history far better than I do, but I seem to recall a Paul von Hindenburg saying something about that he, as chancellor, would, he said, I will control this Mr. Hitler. And I didn't even like saying his name over there. I said, and that worked out how? And my friends both said, oh, yeah, we know, but it's hard to get people to understand that. Creepy. It's a lovely evening. As we... Oh, one other thing, and it was the Sunday of Memorial Day, and I had walked down to the festival. I decided to try the gyro. They serve it with a little bit of really mild sweet and sour. It's not like sauerkraut. It's not like you get on a hot dog in New York. It's really kind of sweet and sour and delightful, along with the tzatziki and the gyro and the roll. Oh, wonderful. But I sat there, having a beer and having my sandwich. And one of the bands there struck up a marching bandish kind of tune. And suddenly I had another epiphany. Yeah, you'll recognize it. Let's see if we can find it here. Yeah, this is it. So you get a sense of a little bit of the flavor of what I heard that day. And of course, that's Gary Owen, long ago, the marching tune of the 7th Cavalry. It's what Custer's 7th Cavalry was playing as they marched into their demise at the Little Bighorn. And suddenly I realized it was Memorial Day weekend. And like I said, for the second time, tears came to my eyes because I realized I was probably the first in my family to be back on European soil like that since two of my uncles had not come home. Now, the irony came in that the fact that the band was apparently giving us a twofer, because after it played Gary Owen, it fired up another little tune. And I recognized this, too. The singing wasn't there, but the imagine it played by a marching band. That's the Panzer lead. And I kind of finished my beer off it quick and toddled on back down the path. That was a bit much. But Fred and Jimmy were very much on my mind because they were, of course, beloved to their families. And I was told repeatedly growing up how much I would have loved knowing them, because their memories were kept alive. Weird little moments of irony. Jim noting via email, he says, "My God, the triumph of the will is forbidden showing in Germany today." I don't know if it is or not. I mean, I'm not gainsaying you, Jim. But that Nazi propaganda. You know, they don't call themselves Nazis. They just kind of allude to it. And they take positions that Nazis would ordinarily take. Somewhere along the way, they got more than 5% of the vote. And 5% is certainly a starting place, and that enabled them to get money to fuel their campaigns. Yeah, they were. Yeah, Kevin, they were banned. This is not the Nazi Party, and they don't fly the Hakenkreuz. But they maintain all of the same policy positions. And their youth sit in black 88 t-shirts with their heads shaved, getting drunk at a monument to German unity. And it was really sad to see that, because so much, almost the vast majority of everything else I saw was such a magnificent display of functioning society, from a healthcare system that worked. There were some frustrations because the 1% are slowly dismantling that as well. To a meaningful retirement system, you know, so much of the social safety net that was put in place beginning in the late 60s by folks like Willy Brandt. And slowly but surely, people are trying, the right wing are trying to dismantle it, and the 1% are trying to dismantle it. Because, remember, they want it all. But my time in that magnificent old house where paintings of the original inhabitants still hung on the wall drew to a close. And on Wednesday this past, we got in the car. Ha-ha! We headed for the Autobahn. And it was a delight. Another one of those little moments of reminders of the profound differences between there and here. Three lanes either side, slow-moving trucks in the right lane, vehicles passing the slow-moving trucks in the center lane, and the left lane reserved for quite often pure magic. We clipped along about 80 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour. But over in that magic left lane, periodically we would be overtaken in flashing microseconds by big, beautiful sedans or sports cars, you know, doing every bit of 130, 140. Phew, gone. At which point, I was doing my best Jethro Bodine, just sitting there with my mouth hanging open, catching flies. Dang, would you look at that? But the driving was impeccable. No one passing on the right, no one with Ohio plates driving slowly in the left lane. Or, you know, pick whatever state that drives slowly in the left lane where you live. Here, you know, that's the norm. Because it's dangerous. And having it explained to me how much of a chore it is and how much it costs to get a driver's license. So, hence, the degree of seriousness with which driving is approached. And we left our region and headed toward Cologne. And as we got toward Cologne, we veered off to the west and we went to a tiny little village, an area of tiny little villages, and a little village called Bure. And there were other little villages around called Kirpen, and a little village called Mannheim. Not with two N's, but with one. Every one of those villages probably 1,000 years old. The geography as flat as a pancake. Absolutely, you could drop a marble and it wouldn't move. And this was where I got to see the dark underbelly of the predatory 1% in Germany. You remember me telling you about the 50% solar? Well, it turns out that 26% of the German energy market is still comprised of coal-fired electricity. Oh, okay, Bob. Yeah, that's better than 36% that it is, 40% that it is here. Yes, absolutely. But if you go to Google Earth and you look up Buir, B-U-I-R, Germany, and then begin looking to its immediate left, you will see a vast, filthy, cancerous scar upon the landscape, and it's what they call open pit mining. Some several square kilometers and 1,400 feet deep, devouring the countryside to feed a coal-fired power plant that you can see pumping filth into the air on the far horizon to the west. And it's expanding, as it was explained to me by our local hosts. It will eventually, if you look at Buhr on Google Earth, it will eventually come right up to the edge of that 1,000-year-old village, and in the process will have consumed in its expansion a forest and 5 other villages. That flat topography, where periodically there are stands of trees, and just topping the trees, you see the point of the spire of the village church. We drove through some of them. And they're going to be erased. Not for Germany's burgeoning coal needs, but for the 1%'s burgeoning and ever unsatisfied desire for profit. The power company owns the coal mine. It's called RWE, and they are predators. And they've gone 1,400 feet into the earth itself with these giant earth-moving machines. Every bit as horrifying looking as a dragline with great serrated teeth, the circular blades that gouge into the earth itself. And they've gone 1,400 feet deep to get to a layer of something that you probably already know about called lignite. And that lignite is there. And it's basically carboniferous mud. It's not even really coal. In the course of this visit, I was taken into the threatened forest, and I met there a group of young tree sitters who have built a little village of their own inside the forest itself. Taking cues, either consciously or from the description of the early church in which they said we held all things in common for the good of all, they've got a little clothing space there where people can take clothing that they might need. They've pitched tents. One guy has built a house in one of the trees and plans to build a series of platforms so that he can go from his house in the tree all the way to the little tree sitter camp and never have to touch the ground. And they are occupying this forest in the hope of stopping the destruction of that entire beautiful, beautiful area west of Cologne. And they took us up and showed us the edge of the strip mine itself. And I saw a series of pump stations in the ground. And I asked, what are those? And they said, that's where they control the groundwater supply. They've already sunken pumps into the ground so that they can completely dry up the groundwater and pump it away at the flick of a switch. I said, so you're telling me that they can dry up the water underneath this forest and just kill the forest at the flip of a switch? And they said, absolutely. And it is planned that that forest that you can see on Google Earth will be gone this fall. And the continuous march of this cancer from this coal company will continue across that lovely, rich, fertile German agricultural space with those five doomed thousand-year-old villages in it. I met amazing people there. I met Peter and his son Max, who kindly hosted us and showed us what there was to learn, shared a meal with us. It was a joy to meet them because they are struggling. They are in this same struggle to save their towns, their homes, no more, no less than we are engaged in a struggle here, and my friends and colleagues out west are engaged in a struggle there. And we are building, and I think this is the important thing as we come to the close of this massive filibobster. I think this is the important thing to remember. We are coming to a place where we are realizing there is a way to beat these predatory monsters. And it is the realization that I've mentioned from time to time and time and again that our struggle is one and the same. Whether it is Ikon and his neighbors in Indonesia, or Peter and Max, and Boer, my good friends, my dear colleagues in Appalachia, my new friends out west in Wyoming and Missoula, and heading further west into Portland and Seattle. And one more friend that I would make at the Deutsche Bank annual general meeting there back in Frankfurt, where we gave our presentation, and a haughty, smug bastard by the name of Josef Ackermann, who is the toast and dear friend of Chancellor Merkel, told me that I simply didn't know what I was talking about. that Deutsche Bank would never do such a thing. He said, I come from Switzerland, and we love our mountains, and people would be very unhappy with me there if I was financing the destruction of mountains. When in fact, we had the data in hand that showed that Deutsche Bank had given a revolving line of credit to Alpha Natural Resources, the single greatest practitioner of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. But the 1% do that. They just lie. They just lie. And there I met a new friend from India, who was engaged in the struggle there with a massive, vile, filthy coal company called Coal India that is hoping Deutsche Bank will fund them. And we had some conversation and we shared that idea that we are getting to the point where we can win because we are realizing that the struggle is the same no matter where we are. The struggle is not against a local coal company, but against the very idea of it being used to power the 21st century at the expense of people's homes, their families, and their lives. And so my profound thanks go out to my new friends at Urgewald, and my continuing thanks go out to those I refer to constantly as the hardest working, bravest people I know, Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, without whom none of this would have been possible. And there are still more stories to tell. But tonight I wanted to get the biggest part of the story told. And I thank you for your patience in listening to this 3-hour filibuster. Thanks to everybody who makes all this happen. The fact of the matter is, with me having been gone for 2 weeks in May, we are in desperate, terrible, awful, god-awful financial shape. We've got bills that are due right now that we can't pay. If you can help by hitting the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, it would be monumentally important. We very likely will, well, if we don't do something rather quickly, we will lose our toll-free service as of Wednesday, because fundraising fell to almost nothing at the middle of May, because you know, there were no shows. But the effort continues, and it continues because of your determination. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Susan and Jean. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And though it's been a while since I've said this, it is nonetheless true. Always, always, always. Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.